After several moments' silence, both men spoke at once. "After all your kindness to me," began Strange. "You think that I am angry?" began Mr. Norrell. Both paused, and then Strange indicated that Mr. Norrell should continue. "You think that I am angry," said Mr. Norrell. "But I am not. You think I do not know why you have done what you have done. But I do. You think you have put all your heart into that writing, and that everyone in England now understands you. What do they understand? Nothing. I understood you before you wrote a word." He paused, and his face worked as if he were struggling to say something that lay very deep inside him. "What you wrote for me. For me alone." Strange opened his mouth to protest at this surprising conclusion, but upon consideration he realized it was probably true. He was silent. Mr. Norrell continued. "Do you really believe that I have never felt the same longing you feel? It is John Usglass's magic that we do." "Well, of course it is. What else should it be? I tell you, there were times when I was young when I would have done anything, endured anything, to find him and throw myself at his feet. I tried to conjure him up. That was the act of a very young, very foolish man, to treat a king like a footman and summon him to come and talk to me. I considered it one of the most fortunate circumstances of my life that I was unsuccessful. Then I tried to find him using the old spells of election. I could not even make the spells work. All the magic of my youth was wasted in trying to find him. For 10 years, I thought of nothing else."
"You never said any of this before, sir." Mr. Norrell sighed.
"I wish to prevent you from falling into my error." He raised his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
"But by your own account, Mr. Norrell, this was long ago when you were young and inexperienced. You're a very different magician now, and I flatter myself that I am no ordinary assistant. Perhaps if we were to try again—"
"One cannot find so powerful a magician unless he wishes to be found," declared Mr. Norrell flatly. "It is useless to make the attempt. Do you think he cares what happens to England? I tell you, he does not. He abandoned us long ago."
"Abandoned?" said Strange, frowning. "Well, that is rather a harsh word. I suppose years of disappointment would naturally incline one towards a conclusion of that sort, but there are many accounts of people who saw John Usglass long after he had supposedly left England. The glovemaker's child in Newcastle."
Footnote 1. In the late 17th century, there was a glovemaker in the king's city of Newcastle who had a daughter, a bold little thing. One day, this child, whom everyone supposed to be playing in some corner of her father's house, was missed. Her mother and father and brothers searched for her. The neighbors searched. She was nowhere to be found. Then, in the late afternoon, they looked up and saw her coming down the muddy, cobbled hill. Some of them thought for a moment that they saw someone beside her in the dark winter street. But she came on alone. She was quite unharmed, and her story, when they had pierced it together, was this. She had left her father's house to go wandering in the city, and had quickly come upon a street she had never seen before. This street was wide and well-paved, and led her straight up, higher than she'd ever been before, to the gate and courtyard of a great stone house. She had gone into the house and looked into many rooms, but all were silent, empty, full of dust and spiders. On one side of the house there was a suite of rooms where the shadows of leaves fell ceaselessly over walls and floor, as if there were summer trees outside the windows. But there were no trees, and it was, in any case, winter. One room contained nothing but a high mirror. Roman mirrors seemed to have quarrelled at some time, for the mirror showed the room to be filled with birds, but the room was empty. Yet the glovemaker's child could hear birdsong all around her. There was a long, dark corridor with the sound of rushing water, as if some dark sea or river lay at the end of it. From the windows of some rooms she saw the city of Newcastle, but from others she saw a different city entirely, and others showed only high, wild moors and cold blue sky. She saw many staircases winding up inside the house, great staircases at first, which grew rapidly narrower and more twisting as she mounted higher in the house, until at the top there were only such chinks and gaps in the masonry that a child might notice and a child could slip through.
The last of these led to a little door of plain wood. Having no reason to fear, she pushed it open, but what she found on the other side made her cry out. It seemed to her that 1,000 birds thronged the air, so that there was neither daylight nor darkness, but only a great confusion of black wings. A wind seemed to come to her from far away, and she had the impression of immense space, as if she'd climbed up to the sky and found it full of ravens. Lovemaker's child began to be very much afraid, but then she heard someone say her name. Instantly, the birds disappeared, and she found herself in a small room with bare stone walls and a bare stone floor. There was no furniture of any kind, but seated upon the floor was a man who beckoned to her and called her by her name again and told her not to be afraid. He had long, ragged black hair and strange, ragged black clothes. There was nothing about him that suggested a king, and the only symbol of his magicianship was the great silver dish of water at his side. Glovemaker's daughter stayed by the man's side for some hours until dusk, when he led her down through the house into the city to her home. The Yorkshire Farmer, footnote 2. See chapter 33, footnote 3. The Basque Sailor, footnote 3. Perhaps the eeriest tale told of John Usklas's return was that told by a Basque sailor, a survivor of the Spanish king's great armada. After his ship was destroyed by storms on the far northern coasts of England, the sailor and two companions had fled inland. They dared not go near villages, but it was winter and the frost was thick upon the ground. They feared they would die of cold. As night came on, they found an empty stone building on a high hillside of bare frozen earth. It was almost dark inside, but there were openings high in the wall that let in starlight. They lay down upon the earth floor and slept. The Basque sailor dreamt that there was a king who watched him. He woke. Above him, dim shafts of grey light pierced the winter dark. In the shadows at the farthest end of the building, he thought he saw a raised stone dais. As the light grew, he saw something upon the dais, a chair or throne. A man sat upon the throne, a pale man with long black hair wrapped in a black robe. Terrified, the man woke his fellows and showed them the uncanny sight of the man who sat upon the throne. He seemed to watch them, but he never moved, not so much as a finger. Yet it did not occur to them to doubt that he was a living man. They stumbled to the door and ran away across the frozen fields. The Basque sailor soon lost his companions. One man died of cold and heartbreak within the week. The other, determined to try and make his way back to the Bay of Biscay, began to walk south, and what became of him no one knows. But the Basque sailor stayed in Cumbria and was taken in by some farm people. He became a servant at that same farm and married a young girl from a neighbouring farm. All his life he told the story of the stone barn upon the high hills, and he was taught by his new friends and neighbours to believe that the man upon the black throne was the Raven King. The Basque sailor never found the stone barn again, and neither did his friends nor any of his children. And all his life, whenever he went into dark places, he said, "I greet thee, Lord, and bid thee welcome to my heart," in case the pale king with the long black hair should be seated in the darkness waiting for him. Across the expanses of northern England, 1,000,000 darknesses, 1,000,000 places for the king to be. "I greet thee, Lord, and bid thee welcome to my heart." Mr. Norrell made a small sound of irritation. "Hearsay and superstition. Even if those stories are true, which I am very far from allowing, I have never understood how any of them knew that the person they had seen was John Usklas. No portraits of him exist. Two of your examples, the glovemaker's child and the Basque sailor, did not in fact identify him as Usklas. They saw a man in black clothes, and other people told them later that it was John Usklas. But it is really of very little consequence whether or not he returned at this or that time, or was seen by this or that person. The fact remains that when he abandoned his throne and rode out of England, he took the best part of English magic with him. From that day forth, it began to decline. Surely that is enough in itself to mark him as our enemy. You are familiar, I dare say, with Watership's A Fairy Wood Withering.
Footnote 4. A Fairy Wood Withering, 1444, by Peter Watership. This is a remarkably detailed description by a contemporary magician of how English magic declined after John Usglass left England. In 1434, the year of Usglass's departure, Watership was 25, a young man just beginning to practice magic in Norwich. A Fairy Wood Withering contains precise accounts of spells which were perfectly practicable as long as Usglass and his fairy subjects remained in England, but which no longer had any effect after their departure. Indeed, it is remarkable how much of our knowledge of Orient English magic comes from Watership. A Fairy Wood Withering seems an angry book until one compares it with two of Watership's later books, A Defense of My Deeds, written while wrongly imprisoned by my enemies in Newark Castle, 1459-60, and Crimes of the False King, written 1461, published 1697, Penzance. "No, I do not know it," said Strange. He gave Mr. Norrell a sharp look that seemed to say he had not read it for the usual reason. "But I cannot help wishing, sir, that you had said some of this before. Perhaps I have been wrong to keep so much of my mind from you," said Mr. Norrell, knotting his fingers together. "I am almost certain now that I have been wrong. But I decided long ago that Great Britain's best interests were served by absolute silence on these subjects, and old habits are hard to break. But surely you see the task before us, Mr. Strange, yours and mine. Magic cannot wait upon the pleasure of a king who no longer cares what happens to England. We must break English magicians of their dependence on him. We must make them forget John Usglass as completely as he has forgotten us."
Strange shook his head, frowning. "No. In spite of all you say, it still seems to me that John Usglass stands at the very heart of English magic, and that we ignore him at our peril. Perhaps I will be proved wrong in the end. Nothing is more likely, but on a matter of such vital importance to English magic, I need to understand for myself. Do not think that I am ungrateful, sir, but I believe that the period of our collaboration is over. It seems to me that we are too different."
"Oh," cried Mr. Norrell, "I know that in character—" He made a gesture of dismissal. "But what does that matter? We are magicians. That is the beginning and end of me and the beginning and end of you. It is all that either of us cares about. If you leave this house today and pursue your own course, who will you talk to, as we are talking now? There is no one. You will be quite alone." In a tone almost of pleading, he whispered, "Do not do this."
Strange stared in perplexity at his master. This was by no means what he had expected. Far from being driven into a passion of fury by Strange's review, Mr. Norrell seemed only to have been provoked into an outburst of honesty and humility. At that moment, it seemed to Strange both reasonable and desirable to return to Mr. Norrell's tutelage. It was only pride and the consciousness that he was certain to feel differently in an hour or two, which prompted him to say, "I'm sorry, Mr. Norrell, but ever since I returned from the peninsula, it has not felt right to me to call myself your pupil. I felt as if I were acting a part, to submit my writings for your approval so that you can make changes in any way that you see fit. It is what I can no longer do. It is making me say what I no longer believe."
All is to be done in public," sighed Mr. Norrell.
He leaned forward and said with more energy,
"Be guided by me. Promise me that you will publish nothing, speak nothing, do nothing until you are quite decided upon these matters. Leave me when I tell you that 10, 20, even 50 years of silence is worth the satisfaction of knowing at the end that you have said what you ought. No more, no less. Silence and inaction will not suit you, I know that, but I promise to make what amends I can. You will not lose by it. If you have ever had cause to consider me ungrateful, you shall not find me so in future. I shall tell everyone how highly I prize you. We shall no longer be tutor and pupil. Let it be a partnership of equals. Have I not in any case learnt almost as much from you as you have from me? The most lucrative business shall all be yours. The books," he swallowed slightly, "the books which I ought to have lent you, and which I have kept from you, you shall read them. We will go to Yorkshire, you and I together, tonight if you wish it, and I will give you the key to the library,
and you shall read whatever you desire. Mr. Norrell passed his hand across his brow, as if in surprise at his own words. I shall not even ask for a retraction of the review. Let it stand. Let it stand. And in time, you and I together will answer all the questions you raise in it.
There was a long silence. Mr. Norrell watched the other magician's face eagerly. His offer to show Strange the library at Hurtview was not without effect. For some moments, Strange was clearly wavering in his determination to part with his master. But at last he said, I am honored, sir. You are not usually a man for a compromise, I know. But I think I must follow my own course now. I think we must part.
Mr. Norrell closed his eyes. At that moment, the door opened. Lucas and one of the other footmen entered with the tea tray.
Come, sir, said Strange.
He touched his master's arm to rouse him a little, and England's only two magicians took tea together for the last time. Strange left Hanover Square at 8:30. Several people, lingering by their downstairs windows, saw him go. Other people, who scorned to watch themselves, had sent their maids and footmen to stand about the square. Whether Lascelles had made some arrangement of this sort is not known, but 10 minutes after Strange had turned the corner into Oxford Street, Lascelles knocked upon Mr. Norrell's door. Mr. Norrell was still in the library, still in the chair he had been sitting in when Strange had left. He was staring fixedly at the carpet.
Is he gone? Asked Lascelles.
Mr. Norrell did not answer.
Lascelles sat down. Our conditions. How did he receive them?
Still no reply.
Mr. Norrell? You told him what we agreed. You told him that unless he publishes a retraction, we shall be forced to reveal what we know of the black magic done in Spain. You told him that under no circumstances would you accept him any longer as a pupil.
No,
said Mr. Norrell.
I said none of those things.
But,
Mr. Norrell sighed deeply,
it does not matter what I said to him. He is gone.
Lascelles was silent a moment, and looked with some displeasure at the magician. Mr. Norrell, still lost in his own thoughts, did not observe this. Finally, Lascelles shrugged.
You were right in the beginning, sir, he said. There can be only one magician in England.
What do you mean?
I mean that two of anything is a most uncomfortable number. One may do as he pleases. Six may get along well enough, but two must always struggle for mastery. Two must always watch each other. The eyes of all the world will be on two, uncertain which of them to follow.
You sigh, Mr. Norrell. You know that I am right. Henceforth, we must consider Strange in all our plans. What he will say, what he will do, how to counter him. You have often told me that he is a remarkable magician. His brilliance was a great advantage when it was employed in your service. But that is all over now. Sooner or later he is sure to turn his talents against you. We cannot begin to guard against him too soon. I am speaking quite literally. His genius for magic is so great, and his materials so poor, and the end of it will be that he comes to believe that all things are permitted to a magician, be they housebreaking, theft, or deception.
Lascelles leant forward. I do not mean that he is so depraved as to steal from you at this moment, but if a day ever comes when he is in great need, then it will appear to his undisciplined mind that any breach of trust, any violation of private property, is justified.
He paused.
You have made provision against thieves at Hurtview, spells of concealment. Spells of concealment would be no protection against Strange, declared Mr. Norrell angrily. They would only serve to attract his eye. It would bring him straight to my most precious volumes. No, no. You are right, he sighed. Something more is needed here. I must think.
2 hours after Strange's departure, Mr. Norrell and Lascelles left Hanover Square in Mr. Norrell's carriage. 3 servants accompanied them, and they had every appearance on embarking on a long journey. The following day, Strange, as whimsical and contradictory as ever, was inclined to regret his break with Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell's prediction that he would never again have anyone to talk to about magic continually presented itself to his mind. He had been rehearsing their conversation. He was almost certain that all Norrell's conclusions concerning Jarn Usklas were wrong. As a consequence of what Mr. Norrell had said, he had developed a great many new ideas about Jarn Usklas. Now he was suffering all the misery of having no one to tell them to. In the absence of a more suitable listener, he went and complained to Sir Walter Pole in Harley Street. "Since last night, I have thought of 50 things I ought to have said to him. Now I suppose I shall have to put them in an article or a review, which will not be published until April at the earliest. And then he will have to instruct Lascelles or Portishead to write a repudiation, which will not appear until June or July. 5 or 6 months to know what he would say to me. It is a very cumbersome way of conducting an argument, particularly when you consider that until yesterday I could simply have walked to Hanover Square and asked him what he thought, and I am certain now to get no sight nor smell of the books which matter. How is a magician to exist without books? Let someone explain that to me. It is like asking a politician to achieve high office without the benefit of bribes or patronage." Sir Walter took no offense at this peculiarly uncivil remark, but charitably made allowances for the irritation of stranger spirits. As a schoolboy at Harrow, he had been forced to study magical history, which he had loathed, and he now cast his mind back to discover if he remembered anything which might be useful. He found that he did not remember much. As much, he thought wryly, as might half fill a very small wine glass. He thought for a moment or two, and at last offered the following.
"It is my understanding that the Raven King learnt all there is to know of English magic without the aid of any books, since there were none at that time in England. So perhaps you could do the same."
Strange gave him a very cool look. "And it is my understanding that the Raven King was the favorite foster child of King Oberon, which, among other trifles, secured him an excellent magical education and a large kingdom of his own. I suppose that I could take to loitering in out-of-the-way copses and mossy glades in the hopes of being adopted by some fairy royalty, but I rather think that they might find me a little tall for the purpose." Sir Walter laughed.
"And what shall you do now, without Mr. Norrell to fill your days for you? Shall I tell Robson at the Foreign Office to send you some magic to do? Only last week he was complaining that he is obliged to wait until all the work for the Admiralty and the Treasury is done before Mr. Norrell has any time to spare for him."
"By all means. Tell him it cannot be for 2 or 3 months. We're going home to Shropshire. Both Arabella and I have a great desire to be in our own county, and now that we need not consult the convenience of Mr. Norrell, nothing remains to prevent our going."
"Oh," said Sir Walter, "but you're not going immediately."
"In 2 days' time."
"So soon?"
"Do not look so stricken. Really, Pole, I had no idea you were so fond of my company."
"I'm not. I was thinking of Lady Pole. It will be a sad change for her. She will miss her friend."
Oh yes, said Strange, a little discomfited. "Of course." Later that morning, Arabella made her parting visit to Lady Pole. 5 years had made very little difference to her ladyship's beauty, and none at all to her sad condition. She was as silent as ever, and as indifferent to every pain or pleasure. Kindness or coldness left her equally unmoved. She passed her days sitting by the window in the Venetian drawing-room and the house in Harley Street. She never exhibited the least inclination for any occupation, and Arabella was her only visitor.
"I wish you were not going," said her ladyship when Arabella told her the news. "What sort of a place is Shropshire?"
"Oh, I fear I am a very partial judge. I believe that most people would agree that it is a pretty place, with green hills and woods and sweet country lanes. Of course, we shall have to wait for spring to enjoy it completely. But even in winter, the views can be very striking. It is a peculiarly romantic county, with a noble history. There are ruined castles and stones planted on the hilltops by who knows what people. And being so close to Wales, it has often been fought over. There are ancient battlefields in almost every valley."
"Battlefields," said Lady Pole. "I know only too well what that is like. To glance out of a window and see nothing but broken bones and rusting armor everywhere one looks. It is a very melancholy sight. I hope you will not find it too distressing."
"Broken bones and armor," echoed Arabella. "No, indeed.
Your ladyship misunderstands me. The battles were all long ago. There is nothing to see, certainly nothing to distress me. And yet, you know, continued Lady Pole, scarcely attending to her, battles have been fought at some time or other almost everywhere. I remember learning in my schoolroom how London was once the scene of a particularly fierce battle. The people were put to death in horrible ways, and the city was burnt to the ground. We are surrounded by the shadows of violence and misery all the days of our life, and it seems to me that it matters very little whether any material sign remains or not. Something changed in the room. It was as if cold, grey, beating wings had passed over their heads, or as if someone had walked through the mirrors and cast a shadow into the room. It was an odd trick of the light which Arabella had often observed when she sat with Lady Pole. Not knowing what else to attribute it to, she supposed it must be because there were so many mirrors in the room. Lady Pole shivered and pulled her shawl tighter around her. Arabella leaned forward and took her hand. Come, fix your thoughts upon more cheerful objects. Lady Pole looked at her blankly. She had no more idea how to be cheerful than to fly. So Arabella began to talk, hoping to distract her for a time from thinking of horrors. She spoke of new shops and new fashions. She described a very pretty ivory-coloured sarsenet she had seen in the window in Friday Street, and a trimming of turquoise-coloured bugle beads she had seen somewhere else, which would match the ivory sarsenet beautifully. She went on to relate what her dressmaker had said about bugle beads, and then to describe an extraordinary plant that the dressmaker possessed, which stood in a pot on a little iron balcony outside the window, and which had grown so tall in the space of a year that it had entirely blocked up a window on the floor above, belonging to a candlestick maker. Next came other surprising tall plants. Jack and his beanstalk, the giant at the top of the beanstalk, giants and giant killers in general, Napoleon Bonaparte and the Duke of Wellington. The Duke's merits in every sphere of life except in one, the great unhappiness of the Duchess. Happily, it is what you and I have never known anything of, she finished up, a little breathless. To have one's peace continually cut up by the sight of one's husband paying attentions to other women. I suppose so, answered Lady Pole, somewhat doubtfully. This annoyed Arabella. She tried to make allowances for all Lady Pole's oddities, but she found it rather hard to forgive her habitual coolness towards her husband. Arabella could not visit at Harley Street as often as she did without being aware of how very devoted Sir Walter was to Lady Pole. If he ever thought that anything might bring her pleasure or ease her sufferings in the slightest, then that thing was done in an instant, and Arabella could never observe without a pang the very meagre return he got for his pains. It was not that Lady Pole showed any dislike towards him, but sometimes she scarcely seemed to know that he was there. Oh, but you do not consider what a blessing it is, said Arabella. One of the best blessings of existence. What is? Your husband's love. Lady Pole looked surprised. Yes, he does love me, she said at last. Or at least he tells me that he does. But what good is that to me? It has never warmed me when I was cold, and I always am cold, you know. It has never shortened a long, dreary ball by so much as a minute, or stopped a procession through long, dark, ghostly corridors. It has never saved me from any misery at all. Has the love of your husband ever saved you from anything? Mr. Strange, smiled Arabella. No, never. I'm more in the habit of saving him. I mean, she added quickly, since it was clear that Lady Pole did not understand her, that he often meets with people who wish him to do magic on their behalf, or they have a great nephew who wishes to learn magic from him, or they believe that they have discovered a magic shoe or fork or some such nonsense. And they mean no harm. Indeed, they are generally most respectful, but Mr. Strange is not the most patient of men, and so I am obliged to go in and rescue him before he says something that he had much better not. It was time for Arabella to be thinking of leaving, and she began upon her goodbyes. Now that they might not meet again for many months, she was particularly anxious to say something cheerful. And I hope, my dear Lady Pole, she said, that when you and I next meet, you will be a great deal better, and perhaps able to go out into society again. It is my dearest wish that one day we shall see each other at a theatre, or in a ballroom. A ballroom! exclaimed Lady Pole in horror. "What in the world should make you say that? God forbid that you and I should ever meet in a ballroom."
"Hush, hush, I never meant to distress you. I forgot how you hate dancing. Come, do not weep. Do not think of it if it makes you unhappy."
She did her best to soothe her friend. She embraced her, kissed her cheek and her hair, stroked her hand, offered her lavender water. Nothing did any good. For several minutes, Lady Pole was entirely given over to a fit of weeping. Arabella could not quite understand what the matter was. But then again, what understanding could there be? It was part of her ladyship's complaint to be put in a fright by trifles, to be made unhappy by nothing at all. Arabella rang the bell to summon the maid. Only when the maid appeared did her ladyship at last make an effort to compose herself.
"You do not understand what you have said," she cried. "God forbid that you should ever find out, as I have. I shall try to warn you. I know it is hopeless, but I shall try. Listen to me, my dear, dear Mrs. Strange. Listen as if your hopes of eternal salvation depended upon it."
So Arabella looked as attentive as she possibly could. But it was all to no end. This occasion proved no different from any other when her ladyship had claimed to have something of great importance to communicate to Arabella. She looked pale, took several deep breaths, and then proceeded to relate a very odd story about the owner of a Derbyshire lead mine who fell in love with a milkmaid. The milkmaid was everything the mine owner had ever hoped for, except that her reflection always came several minutes too late into a mirror. Her eyes changed color at sunset, and her shadow was often seen dancing wild dances when she herself was still. After Lady Pole had gone upstairs, Arabella sat alone.
"How stupid of me," she thought, "when I know very well that any mention of dancing distresses her beyond measure. How can I have been so unguarded? I wonder what it was that she wished to tell me. I wonder if she knows herself, poor thing. Without the blessing of health and reason, riches and beauty are worthless indeed."
She was moralizing to herself in this strain when a slight noise behind her caused her to look around. Immediately she rose from her seat and walked rapidly towards the door with hands outstretched.
"It is you. How glad I am to see you. Come, shake hands with me. This will be our last meeting for a long time."
That evening she said to Strange, "One person at least is delighted that you have turned your attention to the study of John Usglask and his fairy subjects."
"Oh, and who is that?"
"The gentleman with the thistle-down hair."
"Who?"
"The gentleman who lives with Sir Walter and Lady Pole. I told you before."
"Oh, yes, I remember."
There was a silence of some moments while Strange considered this.
"Arabella," he suddenly exclaimed, "do you mean to tell me that you have still not learned his name?"
He began to laugh. Arabella looked annoyed.
"It's not my fault," she said. "He has never said his name, and I have never remembered to ask him. But I'm glad you take it so lightly. I thought at one time that you were inclined to be jealous."
"I do not remember that I was."
"How odd. I remember it quite distinctly."
"I beg your pardon, Arabella, but it is difficult to be jealous of a man whose acquaintance you made a number of years ago, and whose name you have yet to discover. So, he approves of my work, does he?"
"Yes. He has often told me that you will never get anywhere until you begin to study fairies. He says that that is what true magic is, the study of fairies and fairy magic."
"Indeed. He seems to have very decided views upon the subject. And what, pray, does he know about it? Is he a magician?"
"I do not think so. He once declared that he'd never read a book upon the subject in his life."
"Oh, he's one of those, is he?" said Strange contemptuously. "He has not studied the subject at all, but has managed to devise a great many theories about it. I meet with that sort very often. Well, if he's not a magician, what is he? Can you at least tell me that?"
"I think I can," said Arabella, in the pleased manner of someone who has made a very clever discovery.
Strange sat expectantly.
"No," said Arabella, "I will not tell you.
You will only laugh at me again."
"Probably."
"Well then," said Arabella after a moment, "I believe he is a prince, or a king. He is certainly of royal blood."
"What in the world should make you think that?"
because he has told me a great deal of his kingdoms and his castles and his mansions, though I confess they all have very odd names, and I never heard of a single one before. I think he must be one of the princes that Bonaparte deposed in Germany or Switzerland.
Indeed, said Strange with some irritation. Well, now that Bonaparte has been defeated, perhaps he would like to go home again.
None of these half-explanations and guesses concerning the gentleman with the thistledown hair quite satisfied him, and he continued to wonder about Arabella's friend. The following day, which was to be the Strange's last in London, he walked to Sir Walter's office in Whitehall, with the express intention of discovering who the fellow was. But when Strange arrived, he found only Sir Walter's private secretary, hard at work.
"Oh, Moorcock, good morning. Has Sir Walter gone?"
"He has just gone to Fife House, Mr. Strange."
Footnote 5. Lord Liverpool's London home, a quaint old rambling mansion which stood by the Thames.
"Is there anything I can do for you?"
"No, I do not."
"Well, perhaps. There is something I always mean to ask Sir Walter, and I never remember. I don't suppose that you're at all acquainted with the gentleman who lives at his house."
"Whose house, sir?"
"Sir Walter's."
Mr. Moorcock frowned.
"A gentleman at Sir Walter's house? I cannot think whom you mean. What is his name?"
"Well, that is what I wish to know. I've never seen the fellow, but Mrs. Strange always seems to meet him the moment she steps out of the house. She's known him for years, yet she's never been able to discover his name. He must be a very eccentric sort of person to make such a secret of it. Mrs. Strange always calls him the gentleman with the silvery nose, or the gentleman with the snow-white complexion, or some sort of odd name like that."
But Mr. Moorcock only looked even more bewildered at this information.
"I am very sorry, sir. I do not think I can ever have seen him."
Chapter 40. Depend upon it, there is no such place. June 1815. The Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte had been banished to the island of Elba. However, His Imperial Majesty had some doubts whether a quiet island life would suit him. He was, after all, accustomed to governing a large proportion of the known world, and so before he left France, he told several people that when violets bloomed again in spring, he would return. This promise he kept. The moment he arrived upon French soil, he gathered an army and marched north to Paris in further pursuit of his destiny, which was to make war upon all the peoples of the world. Naturally, he was eager to re-establish himself as emperor, but it was not yet known where he would choose to be emperor of. He had always yearned to emulate Alexander the Great, and so it was thought that he might go east. He had invaded Egypt once before and had had some success there. Or he might go west. There were rumors of a fleet of ships at Cherbourg, ready and waiting to take him to America to begin the conquest of a fresh new world. But wherever he chose, everyone agreed that he was sure to begin by invading Belgium. And so the Duke of Wellington went to Brussels to await the arrival of Europe's great enemy. The English newspapers were full of rumors. Bonaparte had assembled his army. He was advancing with appalling swiftness upon Belgium. He was there. He was victorious. Then the next day, it would appear that he was still in his palace in Paris, never having stirred from there in the first place. At the end of May, Jonathan Strange followed Wellington and the army to Brussels. He had spent the past 3 months quietly in Shropshire, thinking about magic, and so it was hardly surprising that he should feel a little bewildered at first. However, after he'd walked about for an hour or two, he came to the conclusion that the fault was not in him, but in Brussels itself. He knew what a city at war looked like, and this was not it. There ought to have been companies of soldiers passing up and down, carts with supplies, anxious-looking faces. Instead, he saw fashionable-looking shops and ladies lounging in smart carriages. True, there were groups of officers everywhere, but none of them appeared to have any idea of pursuing military business. One was expending a great deal of concentration and effort in mending a toy parasol for a little girl. There was a great deal more laughter and gaiety than seemed quite consistent with an imminent invasion by Napoleon Bonaparte. A voice called out his name. He turned and found Colonel Manningham, an acquaintance of his, who immediately invited Strange to go with him to Lady Charlotte Greville's house. This was an English lady who was living in Brussels. Strange protested that he had no invitation, and anyway, he ought to go and look for the Duke.
but Manningham declared that the lack of an invitation could not possibly matter. He was sure to be welcome, and the Duke was just as likely to be in Lady Charlotte Greville's drawing-room as anywhere else. 10 minutes later, Strange found himself in a luxurious apartment filled with people, many of whom he already knew. There were officers, beautiful ladies, fashionable gentlemen, British politicians, and representatives, so it seemed, of every rank and degree of British peer. All of them were loudly discussing the war and making jokes about it. It was quite a new idea to Strange, war as a fashionable amusement. In Spain and Portugal, it had been customary for the soldiers to regard themselves as martyred, maligned, and forgotten. Reports in the British newspapers had always endeavored to make the situation sound as gloomy as possible. But here in Brussels, it was the noblest thing in the world to be one of His Grace's officers, and the second noblest to be His Grace's magician. "Does Wellington really want all these people here?" whispered Strange to Manningham in amazement. "What will happen if the French attack? I wish I'd not come. Someone is sure to begin asking me about my disagreement with Norrell. I really do not want to talk about it." "Nonsense," Manningham whispered back. "No one cares about that here. And anyway, here is the Duke." There was a little bustle, and the Duke appeared. "Ah, Merlin," he cried, as his eye lighted upon Strange. "I'm very glad to see you. Shake hands with me. You're acquainted with the Duke of Richmond, of course. No? Then allow me to make the introduction." If the assembly had been lively before, how much more spirited it became now His Grace was here. All eyes turned in his direction to discover whom he was talking to, and more interesting still, whom he was flirting with. One would not have supposed to look at him that he had come to Brussels for any other reason than to enjoy himself. But every time Strange tried to move away, the Duke fixed him with a look, as if to say, "No, you must stay. I have need of you." Eventually, still smiling, he inclined his head and murmured in Strange's ear, "There, I believe that will do. Come, there is a conservatory at the other end of the room. We'll be out of the crowd there." They took their seats amid the palms and other exotic plants. "A word of warning," said the Duke. "This is not Spain. In Spain, the French were the detested enemy of every man, woman, and child in the country. But here, matters stand quite differently. Bonaparte has friends in every street, and in a great many parts of the army. The city is full of spies. And so it is our job, yours and mine, to look as if nothing in the world were more certain than his defeat. Smile, Merlin. Take some tea. It will steady your nerves." Strange tried a careless smile, but it immediately turned itself into an anxious frown. And so, to draw His Grace's attention away from the deficiencies of his face, he inquired how His Grace liked the army. "Oh, it's a bad army at best. The most miscellaneous army I ever commanded. British, Belgians, Dutch, and Germans all mixed up together. It's like trying to build a wall out of half a dozen materials. Each material may be excellent in its way, but one cannot help wondering if the thing will hold together. But the Prussian army has promised to fight with us, and Blücher is an excellent old fellow. Loves a fight." This was the Prussian general. "Unfortunately, he's also mad. He believes he's pregnant."
"Ah."
"With a baby elephant."
"Ah."
"But we must put you to work straight away. Have you your books, your silver dish, a place to work? I have a strong presentiment that Bonaparte will appear first in the west, from the direction of Lille. It is certainly the way I would choose, and I have letters from our friends in that city assuring me that he is hourly expected there. That is your task. Watch the western border for signs of his approach, and tell me the instant you catch a glimpse of the French troops."
For the next fortnight, Strange summoned up visions of places where the Duke thought the French might appear. The Duke provided him with two things to help him: a large map, and a young officer called William Hadley Bright. Hadley Bright was one of those happy men for whom fortune reserves her choicest gifts. Everything came easily to him. He was the adored only child of a rich widow. He had wanted a military career. His friends had got him a commission in a fashionable regiment. He had wanted excitement and adventure. The Duke of Wellington had chosen him to be one of his aides-de-camp. Then, just as he had decided that the one thing he loved more than soldiering was English magic, the Duke had appointed him to assist the sublime and mysterious Jonathan Strange. But only persons of a particularly sour disposition could resent Hadley Bright's success. Everyone else
was disarmed by his cheerfulness and good nature. Day after day, Strange and Hadley Bright examined ancient fortified cities in the west of Belgium. They peered at dull village streets. They watched vast, empty vistas of fields beneath even vaster prospects of watercolor clouds. But the French did not appear. On a hot, sticky day in the middle of June, they were seated at this interminable task. It was about 3 o'clock. The waiter had neglected to remove some dirty coffee cups, and a fly buzzed around them. From the open window came the mingled odors of horse sweat, peaches, and sour milk. Hadley Bright, perched on a dining chair, was demonstrating to perfection one of the most important skills of a soldier, that of falling asleep under any circumstances and at any time. Strange glanced at his map and chose a spot at random. In the water of his silver dish, a quiet crossroads appeared. Nearby was a farm and 2 or 3 houses. He watched for a moment. Nothing happened. His eyes closed, and he was on the point of dozing off, when some soldiers dragged a gun into position beneath some elm trees. They had a rather businesslike air. He kicked Hadley Bright to wake him up. "Who are those fellows?" he asked. Hadley Bright blinked at the silver dish. The soldiers at the crossroads wore green coats with red facings. There suddenly seemed to be a great many of them. "Nassauers," said Hadley Bright, naming some of Wellington's German troops. "Prince of Orange's boys. Nothing to worry about. What are you looking at?" "A crossroads 20 miles south of the city, a place called Quatre Bras." "Oh, there's no need to spend time on that," declared Hadley Bright with a yawn. "That is on the road to Charleroi. The Prussian army is at the other end of it, or so I'm told. I wonder if those fellows are supposed to be there." He began to leaf through some papers describing the disposition of the various Allied armies. "No, I really don't think—" "And what is that?" interrupted Strange, pointing at a soldier in a blue coat who had suddenly appeared over the opposite rise with his musket at the ready. There was the merest pause. "A Frenchman," said Hadley Bright. "Is he supposed to be there?" asked Strange. The one Frenchman had been joined by another. Then 50 more appeared. The 50 became 200, 300, 1,000. The hillside seemed to be breeding Frenchmen as a cheese breeds maggots. The next moment, they all began to discharge their muskets upon the Nassauers at the crossroad. The engagement did not last long. The Nassauers fired the cannons. The Frenchmen, who appeared to have no cannons of their own, retreated over the hill. "Ah," cried Strange, delighted. "They are beaten. They have run away." "Yes, but where did they come from in the first place?" muttered Hadley Bright. "Can you look over that hill?" Strange tapped the water and made a sort of twisting gesture above the surface. The crossroads vanished, and in its place appeared an excellent view of the French army, or if not the whole army, a very substantial part of it. Hadley Bright sat down like a marionette whose strings had been cut. Strange swore in Spanish, a language he naturally associated with warfare. The Allied armies were in entirely the wrong place. Wellington's divisions were in the west, ready to defend to the death all sorts of places that Bonaparte had no intention of attacking. General Blücher and the Prussian army were too far east, and here was the French army suddenly popping up in the south. As matters stood at present, these Nassauers, who amounted to perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 men, were all that lay between Brussels and the French. "Mr. Strange, do something, I implore you," cried Hadley Bright. Strange took a deep breath and opened wide his arms, as though he were gathering up all the magic he had ever learnt. "Hurry, Mr. Strange, hurry! I could move the city," said Strange. "I could move Brussels. I could put it somewhere where the French will not find it." "Put it where?" cried Hadley Bright, grabbing Strange's hands and forcing them down again. "We're surrounded by armies, our own armies. If you move Brussels, you're liable to crush some of our regiments under the buildings and the paving stones. The Duke will not be pleased. He needs every man." Strange thought some more. "I have it," he cried. A sort of breeze rushed by. It was not unpleasant. Indeed, it had the refreshing fragrance of the ocean. Hadley Bright looked out of the windows. Beyond the houses, churches, palaces, and parks were mountain ridges that had not been there a moment ago. They were black, as if covered with pine trees. The air was much fresher, like air that had never been breathed before. "Where are we?" asked Hadley Bright. "America," said Strange. And then, by way of an explanation, he added, "It always looks so empty on the maps.
Dear God! But this is no better than before. Have you forgotten that we've only just signed a peace treaty with America? Nothing will excite the Americans' displeasure so much as the appearance of a European city on their soil. Oh, probably, but there's no need for concern, I assure you. We're a long way from Washington or New Orleans or any of those places where the battles were. Hundreds of miles, I expect. Or at least, well, that is to say, I'm not sure where exactly. Do you think it matters?
Footnote 1. The citizens of Brussels and the various armies occupying the city were intrigued to learn that they were now situated in a faraway country. Unfortunately, they were much occupied in preparing for the coming battle, or, in the case of the richer and more frivolous part of the population, in preparing for the Duchess of Richmond's ball that evening. And hardly anyone had leisure just then to go and discover what the country was like or who its inhabitants were. Consequently, for a long time, it was unclear where precisely Strange had put Brussels on that June afternoon. In 1830, a trader and trapper named Pearson Denby was travelling through the plains country. He was approached by a Lakota chief of his acquaintance, a man afraid of the water. A man afraid of the water asked if Denby could acquire for him some black lightning balls. Man afraid of the water explained that he was intending to make war upon his enemies and had urgent need of the balls. He said that at one time he had had about 50 of the balls, and he had always used them sparingly, but now they were all gone. Denby did not understand. He asked if man afraid of the water meant ammunition. No, said man afraid of the water. Like ammunition, but much bigger. He took Denby back to his camp and showed him a brass 5.5-inch howitzer made by the Carron Company of Falkirk in Scotland. Denby was astonished, and asked how Man Afraid of the Water had acquired the gun in the first place. Man Afraid of the Water explained that in some nearby hills lived a tribe called the Half-Finished People. They had been created very suddenly one summer, but their creator had only given them one of the skills men need to live, and that of fighting. All other skills they lacked. They didn't know how to hunt buffalo or antelope, how to tame horses, or how to make houses for themselves. They could not even understand each other, since their crazy creator had given them 4 or 5 different languages. But they had had this gun, which they had traded to Man Afraid of Water in exchange for food. Intrigued, Denby sought out the tribe of half-finished people. At first, they seemed like any other tribe. But then Denby noticed that the older men had an oddly European look, and some of them spoke English. Some of their customs were the same as the Lakota tribes, but others seemed to be founded upon European military practice. Their language was like Lakota, but contained a great many English, Dutch, and German words. A man called Robert Heath, otherwise Little Man Talks Too Much, told Denby that they had all deserted from several different armies and regiments on the afternoon of the 15th of June, 1815, because a great battle was going to be fought the next day, and they had all had a strong presentiment that they would die if they remained. Did Denby know if the Duke of Wellington or Napoleon Bonaparte was now King of France? Denby could not say. Well, sir, said Heath philosophically, whichever of them it is, I dare say life goes on just the same for the likes of you and me. Hadley Bright dashed outside to find the Duke and tell him that, contrary to what he might have supposed, the French were now in Belgium, but he and the Duke was not. His Grace, who happened to be taking tea with some British politicians and Belgian countesses, received the news in his customary imperturbable fashion. But half an hour later he appeared in Strange's hotel with the quartermaster, General Colonel de Lancey. He stared down at the vision in the silver dish with a grim expression. "Napoleon has humbugged me, by God," he exclaimed. "De Lancey, you must write the orders as quickly as you can. We must gather the army at Quatre Bras." Poor Colonel de Lancey looked most alarmed. "But how do we deliver the orders to the officers with all the Atlantic between us?" he asked. "Ah," said His Grace. "Mr. Strange will take care of that." His eye was caught by something outside the window. 4 horsemen were passing by. They had the bearings of kings and the expressions of emperors. Their skin was the colour of mahogany. Their long hair was the shiny jet black of a raven's wing. They were dressed in skins decorated with porcupine quills. Each was equipped with a rifle in a leather case, a fearsome-looking spear, as feathered as their heads, and a bow. "Oh, and De Lancey, find someone to ask those fellows if they would like to fight tomorrow, would you? They look as if they could do the business." An hour or so later, in the town of Arth, 20 miles from Brussels, or rather
20 miles from where Brussels usually stood, a pâtissier took a batch of little cakes from the oven. After the cakes had cooled, he drew a letter upon each one in pink icing, a thing he had never in his life done before. His wife, who knew not a word of English, laid the cakes in a wooden tray and gave the tray to a sous-pâtissier. The sous-pâtissier carried it to the headquarters of the Allied Army in the town where Sir Henry Clinton was issuing orders to his officers. The sous-pâtissier presented the cakes to Sir Henry. Sir Henry took one and was about to carry it to his mouth when Major Norcott, of the 95th Rifles, gave a cry of surprise. There in front of them, written in pink icing on little cakes, was a dispatch from Wellington instructing Sir Henry to move the 2nd Division of Infantry towards Quatre Bras with as little delay as possible. Sir Henry looked up in amazement. The sous-pâtissier beamed at him. At about the same time, the general in charge of the 3rd Division, a Hanoverian gentleman called Sir Charles Alton, was hard at work in a chateau 25 miles southwest of Brussels. He happened to look out of the window and observed a very small and oddly behaved rainstorm in the courtyard. It shed its rain in the centre of the courtyard and touched the walls not at all. Sir Charles was curious enough to go outside and look more closely. There, written in the dust with raindrops, was the following missive. Bruxelles, 15th of June, 1815. The 3rd Division to move upon Quatre Bras immediately. Wellington. Meanwhile, some Dutch and Belgian generals in Wellington's army had discovered for themselves that the French were at Quatre Bras and were on their way there with a 2nd Netherlands Division. Consequently, these generals, whose names were Ribeck and Peponchin, were more annoyed than enlightened when a great mass of songbirds alighted in the trees all around and began to sing. The Duke's ideas let us expound, at Quatre Bras the French are found. All his troops must gather round, to the crossroads all are bound. Yes, yes, we know, cried General Peponchin, gesturing at the birds to shoo them away. Be off, damn you! But the birds only flew closer, and some actually settled upon his shoulders and horse. They continued singing in the most officious manner possible. Their reputations will be made, the Duke commands, be not afraid. All the army's plans are laid, go quickly now with your brigade. The birds accompanied the soldiers for all the remainder of the day, never ceasing for a moment to twitter and cheep the same aggravating song. General Beck, whose English was excellent, managed to catch hold of one of them and tried to teach it a new song, in the hopes that it might return to Jonathan Strange and sing it to him. The Duke's magician must be kicked from Bruxelles to Maastricht for playing tricks on honest men to Maastricht and back again. Footnote 2. General Rebecca also made up a Dutch version of his jingle, which was sung by his soldiers on the way to Quatre Bras. They taught it to their English comrades, and it later became a child's skipping rhyme both in England and the Netherlands. At 6 o'clock, Strange returned Brussels to European soil. Immediately, those regiments which had been quartered inside the city marched out of the Namur Gate and down the road that led to Quatre Bras. That done, Strange was able to make his own preparations for war. He collected together his silver dish, half a dozen books of magic, a pair of pistols, a light summer coat with a number of unusually deep pockets, a dozen hard-boiled eggs, 3 flasks of brandy, some pieces of pork pie wrapped in paper, and a very large silk umbrella. The next morning, with these necessaries stowed in various places about his person and his horse, he rode with the Duke and his staff up to the crossroads at Quatre Bras. Several thousand Allied troops were assembled there now, but the French had yet to show themselves. From time to time there was the sound of a musket, but it was scarcely more than you would hear in any English wood where gentlemen are shooting. Strange was looking about him when a song thrush alighted upon his shoulder and began to chirrup. The Duke's ideas let us expound, at Quatre Bras the French are found. What? Muttered Strange. What are you doing here? You're supposed to have disappeared hours ago. He made Ormskirk sign to disperse a magic spell, and the bird flew off. In fact, rather to his consternation, a whole flock of birds took flight at the same moment. He glanced around nervously to see if anyone had noticed that he'd bungled the magic, but everyone seemed busy with military concerns, and he concluded they had not. He found a position to his liking in a ditch directly in front of Quatre Bras farmhouse. The crossroads was on his immediate right, and the 92nd Foot, the Highland Regiment, were on his left. He took the hard-boiled eggs out of his pockets and gave them to such of the Highlanders as thought they might like to eat them. In peacetime, some sort of introduction is generally required to make a person's acquaintance. In war, a small eatable will perform the same office. The Highlanders gave him some sweet milky tea in return, and soon they were chatting very companionably together. The day was intensely hot. The road went down between the fields of rye, which seemed under that bright sun to glow with an almost supernatural brilliance. 3 miles away, the Prussian army had already engaged with the French, and there were faint sounds of guns booming and men shouting, like the ghosts of things to come. Just before noon, drums and fierce singing were heard in the distance. The ground began to shake with the stamping of tens of thousands of feet, and through the rye, towards them, came the thick, dark columns of French infantry. The Duke had given Strange no particular orders, and so, when the fighting began, he set about performing all the magic he used to do on Spanish battlefields. He sent fiery angels to menace the French, and dragons to breathe flames over them. These illusions were larger and brighter than anything he had managed in Spain. Several times he climbed out of the ditch to admire the effect, in spite of the warnings of the Highlanders that he was liable to be shot at any moment. He had been diligently casting such spells for 3 or 4 hours when something happened. Out on the battlefield, a sudden assault by the French chasseurs threatened to envelop the Duke and his staff. These gentlemen were obliged to wheel round and ride pell-mell back to the Allied lines. The nearest troops happened to be the 92nd Foot.
92nd, cried the Duke, lie down!
The Highlanders immediately lay down. Strange looked up from the ditch to see the Duke upon Copenhagen. Footnote 3. Copenhagen, the Duke's famous chestnut horse, 1808-36. Skimming over their heads, His Grace was quite unharmed, and indeed appeared more invigorated than alarmed by his adventure. He looked around to see what everyone was doing. His eye alighted upon Strange.
Mr. Strange, what are you doing? When I want a display of Vauxhall Gardens magic, I shall ask for it.
Footnote 4. In 1810, Messrs. George and Jonathan Barrett, the proprietors of Vauxhall Gardens, had offered Strange and Norrell a vast sum of money to stage displays of magic every night in the gardens. The magic which the Barretts were proposing was of exactly this sort, illusions of magical creatures, famous persons from the Bible and history, etc., etc. Naturally enough, Mr. Norrell had refused.
The French saw plenty of this sort of thing in Spain. They're not in the least disturbed by it. But it is entirely new to the Belgians, Dutch, and Germans in my army. I've just seen one of your dragons menace a company of Brunswickers in that wood. 4 of them fell over. It will not do, Mr. Strange. It simply will not do.
He galloped off. Strange stared after him. He had half a mind to make some pointed remarks about the Duke's ingratitude to his friends, the Highlanders. But they seemed a little busy at the moment, being shot at by cannons and hacked at by sabres. So he picked up his map, climbed out of the ditch, and made his way to the crossroads, where the Duke's military secretary, Lord Fitzroy Somerset, was looking about him with an anxious air.
My lord, said Strange, I need to ask you something. How is the battle going?
Somerset sighed.
All will be well in the end, of course it will, but half the army is not here yet. We have scarcely any cavalry to speak of. I know you sent the divisions their orders very promptly, but some of them were simply too far away. If the French get reinforcements before we get ours, then...
He shrugged.
And if French reinforcements do come, which direction will they come from?
The south, I suppose.
The south and southeast.
Strange did not return to the battle. Instead, he walked to Quatre Bras Farm, just behind the British lines. The farm was quite deserted. Doors stood open, curtains billowed out of windows. A scythe and a hoe had been thrown down in the dust in the haste to get away. In the milk-smelling gloom of the dairy, he found a cat with some newborn kittens. Whenever the gun sounded, which was often, the cat trembled. He fetched her some water and spoke to her gently. Then he sat down upon the cool flagstones and placed his map before him. He began to move the roads, lanes, and villages to the south and east of the battlefield. First, he changed the position of 2 villages. Then he made all the roads that went east to west run north to south. He waited 10 minutes, and then he put it all back the way it was. He made all the woods in the vicinity turn round and face the other way. Next, he made the brooks flow in the wrong direction. Hour after hour, he continued to change the landscape. It was intricate, tedious work, quite as dull as anything he had done with Norrell. At 6:30, he heard the Allied bugles sound the advance. At 8 o'clock, he stood up and stretched his cramped limbs. "Well," he remarked to the cat, "I have not the least idea whether that achieved anything or not." Footnote 5. The accepted magical technique for creating confusion within roads, landscapes, rooms, and other physical spaces is to make a labyrinth within them. But Strange did not learn this magic until February 1817. Nevertheless, this was arguably the decisive action of the campaign. Unknown to Strange, the French general, Dillon, was trying to reach the battlefield with 20,000 men. Instead, he spent those crucial hours marching through a landscape which changed inexplicably every few minutes. Had he and his men succeeded in reaching Quatre Bras, it is probable the French would have won, and Waterloo would never have happened. Strange was piqued by the Duke's abruptness earlier in the day, and did not mention to anyone what he'd done. Later he told John Segundus and Thomas Levy. Consequently, historians of Quatre Bras were perplexed to account for Delon's failure until John Segundus's The Life of Jonathan Strange was published in 1820. Black smoke hung over the fields. Those dismal attendants of any battle, the crows and ravens, had arrived in their hundreds. Strange found his friends, the Highlanders, in a most forlorn condition. They had captured a house next to the road, but in doing so they had lost half their men and 25 of their 36 officers, including their colonel, a man whom many of them had regarded as a father. More than one grizzled-looking veteran was sitting with his head in his hands, weeping. The French had apparently returned to Fresnes, the town they had come from that morning. Strange asked several people if this meant that the Allies had won, but no one seemed to have any precise information upon this point. He slept that night in Genappe, a village 3 miles up the road to Brussels. He was at breakfast when Captain Hadley Bright appeared, bearing news. The Duke's allies, the Prussian army, had received a terrible beating in the fighting of previous day. "Are they defeated?" asked Strange. "No, but they have retreated, and so the Duke says we must do the same. His Grace has chosen somewhere to fight, and the Prussians will meet us there, a place called Waterloo." "Waterloo? What a ridiculously odd name," said Strange. "It is odd, is it not? I could not find it on the map." "Oh," said Strange, "this was continually happening in Spain. No doubt the fellow who told you got the name wrong. Depend upon it, there is no such place as Waterloo." A little after noon they mounted their horses and were about to follow the army out of the village when a message arrived from Wellington. A squadron of French lancers was approaching, and could Mr. Strange do something to annoy them? Strange, anxious to avoid another accusation of Vauxhall Gardens magic, asked Hadley Bright's advice. "What do cavalry hate the most?" Hadley Bright thought for a moment. "Mud," he said.
"Mud? Really? Well, yes, I suppose you're right.
There are few things more plain and workmanlike than weather magic." The skies darkened. An inky thundercloud appeared. It was as large as all Belgium, and so full and heavy that its ragged skirts seemed to brush the tops of the trees. There was a flash, and the world turned bone white for an instant. There was a deafening crack, and the next moment the rain came down in such torrents that the earth boiled and hissed. Within minutes the surrounding fields had turned to a quagmire. The French lancers were quite unable to indulge in their favourite sport of fast and dexterous riding. Wellington's rearguard got safely away. An hour later, Strange and Hadley Bright were surprised to discover that there was indeed a place called Waterloo, and that they had arrived at it. The Duke was sitting on his horse in the rain, gazing in high good humour at the filthy men, horses and carts.
"Excellent mud, Merlin," he called out cheerfully. "Very sticky and slippery. The French will not like it at all. More rain, if you please. Now, you see that tree where the road dips down?"
"The elm, Your Grace."
"The very one. If you will stand there during the battle tomorrow, I will be much obliged to you. I will be there some of the time, but probably not very often. My boys will bring you your instructions."
That evening the various divisions of the Allied army took up positions along a shallow ridge south of Waterloo. Above them the thunder roared and the rain came down in torrents. From time to time deputations of bedraggled men approached the elm tree and begged Strange to make it stop, but he only shook his head and said, "When the Duke tells me to stop, I shall." But the veterans of the Peninsular War remarked approvingly that rain was always an Englishman's friend in times of war. They told their comrades, "There's nothing so comforting or familiar to us, you see,
whereas other nations it baffles. It rained on the nights before Fuentes, Salamanca, and Vitoria.
These were the names of some of Wellington's great victories in the peninsula. In the shelter of his umbrella, Strange mused on the battle to come. Ever since the end of the Peninsular War, he'd been studying the magic that the Oriots used in times of war. Very little was known about it. There were rumours, nothing more, of a spell which John Usklas had used before his own battles. It foretold the outcome of present events. Just before nightfall, Strange had a sudden inspiration. There is no way of finding out what Usklas did, but there's always Pale's conjectures concerning the foreshadowing of things to come. That's very likely a watered-down version of the same thing. I could use that. For a moment or two before the spell took effect, he was aware of all the sounds around him. Rain splashing on metal and leather and running down canvas. Horses shuffling and snorting. Englishmen singing and Scotsmen playing bagpipes. Two Welsh soldiers arguing over the proper interpretation of a Bible passage. The Scottish captain, John Kincaid, entertaining the American savages and teaching them to drink tea, presumably with the idea that once a man had learnt to drink tea, the other habits and qualities that make up a Briton would naturally follow. Then, silence. Men and horses began to disappear, few by few at first, and then more quickly, hundreds, thousands of them vanishing from sight. Great gaps appeared among the close-packed soldiers. A little further to the east, an entire regiment was gone, leaving a hole the size of Hanover Square. Where moments before all had been life, conversation, and activity, there was now nothing but the rain and the twilight and the waving stalks of rye. Strange wiped his mouth because he felt sick. Ah, he thought. That will teach me to meddle with magic meant for kings. Narl is right. Some magic is not meant for ordinary magicians. Presumably John Usklas knew what to do with this horrible knowledge. I do not. Should I tell someone? The Duke. He will not thank me for it. Someone was looking down at him. Someone was speaking to him. A captain in the horse artillery. Strange saw the man's mouth move, but he heard not a sound. He snapped his fingers to dismiss the spell. The captain was inviting him to come and share some brandy and cigars. Strange shivered and declined. For the rest of the night he sat by himself under the elm tree. Until this moment, it had never seemed to him that his magicianship set him apart from other men. But now he had glimpsed the wrong side of something. He had the eeriest feeling, as if the world were growing older around him, and the best part of existence, laughter, love, and innocence, were slipping irrevocably into the past. At about 11:30 the next morning, the French guns began to fire. The Allied artillery replied. The clear summer air between the two armies was filled with drifting veils of bitter black smoke. The French attack was chiefly directed at the Chateau of Hougoumont, an Allied outpost in the valley whose woods and buildings were defended by the 3rd Foot Guards, Coldstream Guards, Nassauers, and Hanoverians. Strange summoned vision after vision into his silver dish so that he could watch the bloody engagements in the woods around the chateau. He was in half a mind to move the trees to give the Allied soldiers a better shot at their attackers, but this sort of close hand-to-hand fighting was the very worst subject for magic. He reminded himself that in war, a soldier may do more harm by acting too soon or too impetuously than by never acting at all. He waited. The cannonade grew fiercer. British veterans told their friends that they have never known shot fall so fast and thick. Men saw comrades cut in half, smashed to pieces or beheaded by cannonballs. The very air shook with the guns' reverberations.
"Hard pounding, this," remarked the Duke coolly, and ordered the front ranks to withdraw behind the crest of the ridge and lie down.
When it was over, the Allies lifted their heads to see the French infantry advancing through the smoke-filled valley. 16,000 men, shoulder to shoulder in immense columns, all shouting and stamping together. More than one soldier wondered if at last the French had found a magician of their own. The French infantrymen appeared much taller than ordinary men, and the light in their eyes as they drew closer burnt with an almost supernatural fury. But this was only the magic of Napoleon Bonaparte, who knew better than anyone how to dress his soldiers so they would terrify the enemy, and how to deploy them so that any onlooker would think them indestructible. Now Strange knew exactly what to do.
The thick, clogging mud was already proving a decided hindrance to the advancing soldiers. To hamper them further, he set about enchanting the stalks of rye. He made them wind themselves around the Frenchman's feet. The stalks were as tough as wires. The soldiers staggered and fell over. With luck, the mud would hold them down, and they would be trampled by their comrades, or by the French cavalry, who soon appeared behind them. But it was painstaking work, and in spite of all his efforts, this first magic of Strange's probably did no more harm against the French than the firing of a skillful British musketeer or rifleman. An aide-de-camp flew up with impossible velocity and thrust a strip of goatskin into Strange's hand with a shout of, "Message from His Grace!" In an instant, he was off again. "French shells have set the chateau of Cougamont on fire. Put out the flames." Wellington.